The North, WBZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. The remnants of Hurricane Francine are still a threat, says ABC News forecaster Lee Goldberg.
The heaviest rain is through Arkansas and into western Tennessee, but a flood watch extends all the way down to the Florida Panhandle. And that'll go into the day tomorrow. Even though the rain will break up some and the winds will back off, we'll still have localized downpours, the threat for flooding, and even a little bit of severe weather. We're still in the peak of hurricane season, and we've got activity. We'll probably have Tropical Storm Gordon later tonight in the eastern Atlantic.
Tens of thousands of Boeing workers today have cast ballots on the company's latest contract offer that could trigger a major strike. In Nashville, a Southwest plane crossed in front of an Alaska Airlines jet as it was taking off. The Alaska plane slammed on its brakes at 119 miles an hour, which caused all the tires to blow. Abortions are now legal in North Dakota after the state Supreme Court ruled its near-total abortion ban was unconstitutionally vague. This is ABC News. Investigators trying to determine how a person in Missouri caught the bird flu. The case has raised questions about the possibility of human-to-human transmission, but health officials say there's no evidence of anybody else infected. A day in court for Baby Reindeer?
The Netflix limited series Baby Reindeer could win big at the Emmys this weekend, but will it win big in court? We may not know until next year.
I really don't know where it's going to end.
A date has been set for May 2025 for the defamation lawsuit against Netflix, in which Fiona Harvey claims the show's stalkers based on her, but the series lies about her interactions with show star and creator Richard Gadd. Gadd has said that the character that stalks him in the show, which is supposed to be based on real-life events, is not Fiona Harvey. Harvey is seeking $170 million in damages from the streaming service.
ABC's Jason Nathanson. Salman Rushdie's Knife Meditations After an Attempted Murder is a nominee for the National Book Awards. Other nonfiction nominees include Richard Slotkin's A Great Disorder. Chuck Sievertson, ABC News.
The kids are heading back to class, but when the subject is school, we have to talk about the first kindergarten started in Wisconsin. Marguerite Schurz created what is known as America's First Kindergarten in 1856, teaching a small class at her family's home in Watertown. It's about 50 miles west, northwest of Milwaukee. So can you guess, when did kindergarten become part of the state's public school system? The answer coming up. Schurz learned about kindergarten in Germany, where the idea was common. It wasn't in America, and her class grew so quickly, she had to move to a bigger space. Today, the building remains as a Watertown museum. So did you guess when kindergarten became part of the public school system in the state? It was 1898. But 42 years prior, the Schurz School started it all, making this a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
I'm James Kelly with WBZH News, your news roundup in quick podcast form. Find it anytime on the WBZH website at buzzofthenorth.com.
Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. It was 23 years ago today that America changed. And we all remember where we were on this date. We remember who we were with, what we were doing, and what we were feeling. And, you know, it's one of these things where having kids who weren't around during that period, you know, around this time, they begin to ask questions. What was America like before? What was pre-9/11 America like? And, you know, you go back and you look at how dramatic the shift in our politics, in our interpersonal relationships, in our community, that one day was in our lives and in the history of this country. We can't go back and change this day, but there's part of me that really wants to go back and change who we've become out of it. They say never let a good crisis go to waste. Well, there are some who did not let this go to waste. They did use it for government overreach. They did use it to hyper-privatize. They did use it to, well, create more divisions in our community and not less. And I remember in the days, weeks, and even months after 9/11, 2001, that we did put down our differences for a short period of time. I didn't vote for George W. Bush, but I rallied behind him, wanting my president to succeed. And from that moment, the decisions that were made by that administration then began to tear at the fabric of who we are and what we do. And look, you know, I'm not going to rehash the last 23 years of foreign policy and domestic policy, but it does make us think about how we deal with each other. I think back to that day, and I remember where I was. I was in a hospital in Cleveland. We were at the Cleveland Clinic. My grandmother was having a knee replacement, and you know, and I've said this before. You know, in her life, she lived through World War II. She lived through Korea, through Vietnam. She lived through, you know, all of these conflicts. But she went under the knife. America was here. When she woke up, everything had changed again. And she likened it to, you know, the kind of footing that she remembers as a younger woman, you know, during World War II, community that came together. The fear, though, for me had always been the things that tear us apart. Now, their generation took that and they kind of stuck together. They pushed for policies to make lives better here at home. They pushed for policies to pull communities together. We went the opposite direction, pointed fingers, divided. I remember going to several meetings while we were debating the Homeland Security bill, the Patriot Act. And I remember watching, because at that point I was just somebody who liked to sit back and watch the fireworks happen. I remember watching the different factions already start to form. And the sides begin to pit each other against each other and the arguments. And I still never forget the League of Women Voters did a panel on the Patriot Act. They had a panel of six people, three people who had read it, three people who had not. They got the talking points. Oddly enough, the people who got the talking points were for it. The people who actually read it were against it. And in that, the entertainment began. And you could argue that those who never let a good crisis go to waste knew what they were doing. They were consolidating power into the hands of a few. They used it as an opportunity to do more tax cutting and more deregulation and all of the things that the right has been pushing for. Every anniversary, I go back to this moment and I say, is it possible to undo the damage to who we are? Is it possible to go back to who we were on September 10th, 2001? Is it possible that who we voted for in the last presidential election doesn't define who we are? Can we go back to where, year round, we're no longer wearing our political choices on our shirts? Look, politics is important. I'm going to be the first to tell you. This is what I do. But we used to have people in our lives who we disagreed with. And I always said, and again, this I guess is a pre-9/11 thought, the great thing about this country is that we can disagree. We can disagree vehemently. And we don't have to kill each other. I fear as the rhetoric has ramped up, I fear as the propaganda and the push for the others, as that continues, that we pull back a little bit. And look, I look at Donald Trump as a clear and present danger to our democracy, to the future of this country, because he has shown us who he has been. And that comes out of who we put at the front of this stuff. And what's interesting to me is that when I talk to my red hat friends, they view Kamala Harris in the same light. Without any real She didn't have a January 6th. She didn't say she can shoot someone on Fifth Avenue. She didn't go out in her rallies and say, you know, beat the you-know-what out of that person. She's not the one out there stoking violence. And this is where our politicians used to be the best of us, or at least pretend to be. At least the show was civility and decency. At least that was, you know, when you said, do you want your child to grow up to be, you know, governor? Yeah, everyone, when I was a kid, wanted their child to grow up to be someone respected and esteemed. But what we've done in this country to our institutions, I don't know is repairable. I hope it is. Because we've got big problems ahead. And if we're unable to solve them, my kids and their kids are going to suffer. Now, my youngest daughter is applying to a program at school called Model UN. And she had to write a paper on, you know, why she wants to be part of this. And I got to tell you, I'm proud as I can be of what she wrote. Because she talked about, you know, using institutions to solve big problems, to work across borders, and to listen to each other. Not just hear the words, but understand the culture and understand the differences and take those seriously into account. That the only way forward is through cooperation, coordination, and communication. The only way forward is through compassion, empathy, and action. And as I was reading her paper, my mind went to this place of, yeah, I would like to go back to this. I would like to go back to a time where, as a country, we believed we could do big things and we could use our government to do those big things that we individually cannot do. That collectively we can solve problems. Collectively, we can find a way forward as opposed to simply being divided. Because right now our government's broken. There is a faction in our government hell-bent on ensuring that nothing happens. Nothing gets done. No solutions to problems, because the problems are more important. Because that's how they get elected. That's how they get campaign money. That's how the system of chaos and conflict work. And until we demand it stop, we're going to continue to be pitted against each other. And I think back to the quote attributed to Jay Gould, the railroad magnate from the 1880s. I can easily pay half the working class to murder the other half. Well, they're not paying, but they have us divided, and we are pitted against each other. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Gonna take a quick break. When we come back, Jackie Simon from AFGE is going to be here to share some thoughts on this efficiency commission that Trump has suggested. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So last Thursday, during his speech in front of the Economic Club of New York, Former President Donald Trump said he would create a government efficiency commission. The idea that he has, the brainchild of Elon Musk, was to create a commission to audit the entire federal government. And of course, billionaire union buster Elon Musk would lead it. Now, you may remember Trump called Musk the greatest cost cutter and praised him for firing striking workers. So I think we kind of have an idea where this could go, but here to share some thoughts on what this could look like and why it's such a bad idea, I've asked Jackie Simon to come talk with us. Jackie is the Director of Public Policy for the American Federation of Government Employees, AFGE. Jackie, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
So this brainchild idea, we're gonna ferret out waste, fraud, and abuse. This seems to be the rallying cry for every conservative, Republican, right-wing loony out there as a way to destroy, to hamstring, to handcuff government. I'm curious your thoughts.
Well, I think it would be impossible to find an individual with more conflicts of interest when it comes to auditing federal government programs and agencies than Elon Musk. His business interests run the gamut with regard to regulation in almost every agency in the executive branch. You've got the National Transportation Safety Board regulating his Teslas that you know kill people and turn out not to to be very reliable. You've got the Department of Labor, you've got the NLRB, you've got NASA, I mean, and of course you've got the FCC and other agencies that would like to regulate X rather than whatever used to be called Twitter. You've got it, and that's only the start. He's also a very, very big government contractor with SpaceX. So, you know, the idea that he would get to reorganize the federal government so that it wouldn't regulate any of his businesses is really, it's farcical.
I said the other day that Musk might be the new Jared Kushner, who's going to have control to end up destroying whatever he can get his fingers on. And this seems to be it. I mean, this seems to be because Trump isn't going to do the work himself. That takes actual work. He's going to put somebody in who will be equally as dangerous, but a lot more motivated.
Well, you know, there's a history of these commissions. 40 years ago, there was the Grace Commission under Ronald Reagan. And, you know, ever since then, that was exactly what they're talking about doing now with Musk. But, you know, even under Obama, there was the Simpson-Bowles Commission. You know, we narrowly avoided that this year. There was supposed to be another one of these, deficit reduction commissions. And AFGE was instrumental in stopping that from happening. It's a big idea that never goes away. It's always ridiculous. And what it really is, you know, contracting out either the responsibility of Congress to appropriate funds to in a way that's efficient and to allow the efficient running of the agencies, or the executive branch to, you know, the president and the White House has a responsibility to make sure that the agencies under their jurisdiction are run efficiently. And it's admitting that they both have failed in that. And they really, in this case with Trump, they just really want to politicize it completely.
I mean, you can always squeeze the quarter until the eagle screams a little bit more. You can always try and wring out a little bit of more efficiency out of everything. And look, you know, the government is no different. But I look at, you know, I don't know if you've tried to call customer service at any corporation in the entire country. Good luck talking to a human being. So this idea that we're going to move government, which is supposed to be responsive to we the people, to the hands of the privateers who've already shown us how they're going to respond to us, I don't know that that's what I want. I don't want someone like Musk, who took over Twitter and fired 2/3 of the workers, and it runs on AI and works well the way that they wanted to, but not the way that it was meant to. It just seems to me that we're privatizing government in a way that I don't think many of us really should want.
Well, I mean, that's, of course, something that's been going on for a long time. And, of course, the we don't know because they remain in the shadows, not by accident. But the contractor workforce, the federal government contractor workforce, is somewhere between 5 and 6 times the size of the regular federal workforce. And so you've got about, you know, you've got millions of people doing the government's work on a for-profit basis for contractors. And they are, they've been, done a very, very good job of making sure that they evade any kind of scrutiny. Certainly nothing close to the level of scrutiny that is imposed on the federal workforce. But there's not an agency in government that doesn't have a very large portion and growing portion of its work performed by private sector contractors.
So maybe a commission to look into that?
that I could buy into.
I mean, yeah, because ultimately, I anything that comes out of Trump's mouth, I view in a skeptical light. This is someone who has told us that he wants to fire all the federal workers and replace them with good patronage hires. We've all seen what the wording of Project 2025. You know, let me ask you, how does this play into that Project 2025? Does this align with what is in the pages of that document that Trump claims he knows nothing about?
Of course. If you go through, Mandate for Leadership, you've got chapter after chapter with proposals for privatizing and contracting out or cutting government programs. But, you know, you can politicize in various ways. One of the ways that Project 2025 would do that is to move the operations of several agencies to the states, block grants, and let the states do whatever they want, just like with abortion. Another way is to, you know, use the budget and just cut. Basically make it impossible for the agency to perform, the duties that are that the law requires. And then the other way, the expensive way, is to contract it all out. And, you know, there's the executive branch, the White House has a tremendous amount of discretion on not only what is contracted out, but how the work is contracted out. And, you know, there are regulations, there are laws that govern the way the way work is supposed to be contracted out. It's supposed to be open to competition. It's supposed to, you know, require the government to, put out a solicitation with very detailed description of the work that they want contractors to do. But after that happens, there's a lot of wheeling and dealing, and there's a lot of negotiation, and there's a lot of ways to put your thumb on the scale to make sure you're directing the money where you want it to be directed. And that is in every chapter of the Project 2025 blueprint. And I think that it would be the method that they use to make government far less efficient than it currently is.
We're going to break it so we can save it, that being that mentality. But, you know, I'm not necessarily against the idea of using contracting if we have to as a way to, raise standards. And I look at some of the conversations around getting the Biden administration to increase the minimum wage for contractors and to ensure that they have union access and a whole bunch of things that should be there. So I guess the difference is which side of that divide are you going to be on? The divide that wants to make lives better, or the divide that, you know, clearly looking at someone like Musk, wants to make lives worse?
Well, higher minimum wages for contractor employees is, you know, something obviously nobody could object to.
Nobody?
On the other hand, if that work were performed inside the government rather than outside the government, the people performing that work would have far higher wages than the minimum wage. They would have guaranteed health insurance. They would have a defined benefit pension. They would have many, many other benefits. The terms of employment in the federal government are better, thanks to AFGE, than many, if not all, federal contractors.
Yeah, so in essence, we the taxpayers are going to pay the same amount regardless if it's a federal
employee. No. I'm not going to let you have that.
No. Let me finish. Let me finish.
More if it's contractors.
Okay, you're going to say more. I'm going to say let's say it's equal. The difference being, and you just laid out the difference of, you know, getting health care and getting retirement security. In the private sector, they don't get that. The contractor, the guy who owns the company, he pockets that that wealth. The worker, it doesn't trickle down to the worker. So the difference is, do we want a workforce that has all the great things that you just laid out, or one where we're fighting to get them into workers to at least minimum wage? So I take your point. It does cost us more to contract out. But my point was, it depends on, you know, who do you want to get that tax dollar, the contractor or the worker?
Yeah, I mean, I think on the most basic level, you know, you can decide whether you want the government's work performed on a for-profit or a not-for-profit basis. And inevitably, no matter what the wages and benefits are, you're going to have higher costs when it's performed by a contractor because of that one line, not one line, many lines in the contracts that guarantee profits to the contractor. In addition, you know, there are limits on what executives, even executives and at the highest level of the federal government can be paid. But there are no such limits. There are some limits. There's one limit on what contractor executives can be paid from taxpayer dollars. The CEO, there's a limit on the CEO, but there's not a limit on all the other executives in the of the contractor, what they can charge what they can charge the federal government for contractor executive salaries. So we are paying millions of dollars to contractor executives that we wouldn't be paying if the government's work were performed in-house.
No, I'm 100% with you. I want the work that we do done by we the people, as opposed to profiteers looking to line your pocket. We 100% agree on this. Now, today obviously is 9/11. We all remember what happened on this day in 2001. How does, you know, this day, the remembrance of this day and the tragedy that took place, how does that play into all of this?
Well, I think that the best answer I can give you at this moment is the chapter in Project 2025 on the Department of Homeland Security, which, of course, was created in the wake of 9/11 to try to improve security, domestic security. One of the proposals in that chapter is to privatize TSA altogether, which is another way of saying, let's go back to pre-9/11 airport security screening. Instead of the professionalized workforce that was created when TSA was created and the Department of Homeland Security was created, people who are well-trained and have responsibilities and technology to perform actually extremely successful airport security training. Nothing's happened in domestic flights since 9/11. They would take us back. They would take us back to minimum wage rent-a-cops and, you know, talk about showing absolutely no regard for the safety and the security of the American flying public. Talk about just absolutely not learning any lessons from the way those kinds of decisions made America more vulnerable and less safe. It's shocking. You can still be shocked at how irresponsible, how just without any kind of scruples these people are.
And again, I come back to what we just talked about a moment ago. Now, this idea of, you know, that somehow this would be cost cutting. I wholeheartedly disagree that it would be. This is that scenario kind of that we were talking about. You're going to privatize something that we were doing for ourselves, and it probably would cost us, if not the same, more in the long run. Well, probably more in the long run than just to continue to do it the way it is. But it's this hatred of government. It's this hatred of you know, we the people doing for ourselves that continually pushes us in this direction.
Yeah. I should also mention, however, that chapter says until we can abolish the Department of Homeland Security and completely abolish TSA and go back to just letting the private the airports and the, you know, hire private contractors to do that work. They want to have a decertification of the union at TSA because federal labor law has a great big loophole in it. And that is if the people who are performing the work are engaged directly in work that involves national security, you can exclude them from bargaining units. And they would argue that TSA, FEMA, CIS, several of the components of DHS are engaged in national security work and thus shouldn't be allowed to have unions.
Why am I not surprised? Jackie, I appreciate you taking time for us. The more I have these conversations, the more it's just how anyone could get, any working person can get behind these ideas is just beyond me. But here we are. Jackie Simon, I appreciate the time.
Thank you very much.
Jackie is the Director of Public Policy there at AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. You can check out their website, afge.org, for more information on what they do. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this.
You're listening to WBZH, Hayward's home for the Todd Allbald Show.
This is your local civic media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Partly cloudy tonight, a low in the mid-50s. And for tomorrow, more sunshine than clouds, highs in the low 80s. For the weekend, a mixture of sunshine and clouds, chance of a few storms, and a little more humid. Highs in the mid-70s Saturday, low 80s Sunday. Currently at 62 degrees.
Get ready to go for the green or gold with Civic Media's new Text to Win contest. When you go for the green or gold, you could win $100 cash, gold jewelry, and be entered to win our grand prize, two indoor club-level seats to see the green and gold in Green Bay. Download the free Civic Media app and get ready to text in for your first chance to win in this statewide contest starting Monday, September 16th. Get ready to go for the green or gold with your local Civic Media radio station.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as the weeks, the days, the hours to Election Day tick down and the political horse race hits its stride, we're going to hear from, you know, from all kinds of pundits and so-called experts who are going to handicap each and every decision, position, policy, every utterance. So it's easy to focus on the minutiae of the day without seeing the bigger picture. Too often we're focused on the elephants behind instead of, well, seeing the entire elephant. And that's why my next guest's new book is so important. Out now to help us see the entire political field, maybe a view from like 50,000 feet. Bob Kramer is a longtime political organizer, strategist, co-founder of Democracy Partners, and the author of this newly released must-read political how-to book, Nuts and Bolts, The Formula for Progressive Electoral Success. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Good to be here with you, Rick.
So great book. As I said, the view from 50,000 feet and perfect timing coming out of the convention, because this convention, tons of energy, tons of, you know, just great messaging. And I was saying, coming out of this, what's that going to look like? You know, walk me through what you see should be coming out of the convention and where we go in the days up to the election.
Well, you know, Vince Lombardi, the great Green Bay Packer coach, you know, used to start each season with this great team by picking up a football and saying, gentlemen, this is a football. You know, he was focused on the fundamentals and executing. And I think that's where we got to be, executing the fundamentals of both political communication and great organizing. Fundamentally, I think this is a turnout election. We got to mobilize our people.
Right.
And make sure they go to the polls, because there are more of us than there are of them if we all go to vote. This book elaborates a number of different kind of fundamentals. There are a couple of them that I think are particularly germane now. The first and foremost, when it comes to political communication, comes from the poet Maya Angelou, who said, I've learned that people will forget what you said, people will forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel. And that, it seems to me, is the crux of what we've got to do. People have got to feel, on the one hand, that our candidates are on their side, and on the other hand, feel inspired. And, you know, an inspiration means something really specific. It means you feel like you're part of something bigger than yourself.
Right.
But that you yourself can play a significant role in achieving the bigger goal.
Yeah, which is why I've been saying, you know, one of the things I hope the Harris campaign does is to reach for ideas and policies that are aspirational, that are bigger than just this moment. The idea of, you know, creating a world that's worthy of being handed off to the next generation, being part of that. And I think she, to a small extent, has done some of that. There's a long way to go, but let me ask you, right path, wrong path?
Well, I think they're moving down the right path. A new way forward is her new slogan. And that focuses on the economic issues that will help people afford their lives. And that says to people, I'm on your side, but also says, you know, saying it is, we got to do this together.
Yeah.
And that's so critical to this feeling of inspiration. And of course, building an army is also enormously important. And she inherited a structure at the Biden campaign had built over months that was ready to absorb this massive influx of volunteers that happened when she became the candidate. And that's very exciting because building armies is viral. It spreads, you know?
No, look, enthusiasm builds on enthusiasm. No, it's great. And that convention showed it. But, you know, in your book, you talk a lot about, you know, kind of what I would view as like old school kind of retail politics. You get out there and press the flesh, shake hands, kiss babies, do all that stuff, knock on doors, make phone calls. Whereas some of the thought process, and I'm not going to pick on a Democratic candidate from 2016 who I don't think did enough of it. But, you know, kind of going back to the old principles of just getting out there and doing the work.
Absolutely. You know, for a long time, there was a time when we heard that the new precinct captain is the television. No, it's not. I mean, the new precinct captain is volunteers out there talking to their neighbors. Tim Wallace brings that whole spirit to the campaign. He's just, you know, understands being a neighbor and mobilizing people that way. One of the other major rules that I've talked about in there is essentially bandwagon. One of the major ways people are persuaded is through social proof. What are their neighbors doing? That's why things like yard signs matter. That's why, you know, what they hear from people at the door matter. By the way, when it comes to the question of what is the best message to get out people to vote who are not going to vote if they don't, they would vote for us if they just went out to vote. There are a bunch of messages that work. Inspiration is one of them, by the way. But another one is, I won't get off your porch until you vote. And that one works better than anything else, really. I mean, we see empirically. I mean, there are just major increases. I mean, give you an example. In New York 3, remember when we were trying to replace Santos with, right. The New York Times Siena poll had it even up the weekend before the election, because their projection was 50% voter turnout for Democrats, 50% for Republican registrants. They forgot there were 300,000 phone calls, 150,000 door knocks. And so our turnout was 8% better than they expected. And we won by 8 points. What a shock. I mean, this stuff really does matter. Yeah. And building armies and volunteering. That's why it's also not a question of what are they going to do. It's a question of what we're going to do in the next 2 months.
No, and I think you hit on that in the book on the idea that there are more registered Democrats. You just got to motivate them to get to the polls, which is why trying to make it easier to vote is something that Democrats try to do, and why Republicans try and block that, because they know, they understand the same math as well.
Absolutely. That's why they do voter suppression for a living. They know if everybody votes, they don't win, because most people don't support things like having the government come into your exam room or making it more difficult to form unions and stick up for your wages and working conditions. You know, I mean, they're perfectly happy for CEOs to make 399 times higher wages than the average worker in their plants. Think about that. Yeah. That's just astounding.
But here's the thing, and you know, one of the talking points I use all the time, and you would think that that would be a motivator to get people out to vote. Because look, I've said there are more of us than there are of them. And not right, left, not red hat, blue hat, up, down, the working class versus, you know, our billionaire elites. There are more of them. We've out-procreated them, but they've got all this money and all this power that comes with, you know, with right-wing media, you know, talk radio, cable news, constant bombardment of messaging through digital media. It just seems like they've understood the idea of divide and conquer much better than we've figured out how to unite people.
Well, it is true that they understand divide and conquer. Part of this has to do with the narrative, though. I mean, our understanding of political messaging about a narrative, there's an antagonist and protagonist. And the antagonist in our narrative needs to be the real people who we're being antagonistic to. The billionaires and big corporations, not another group of people. And I think the Harris-Waltz campaign is beginning to really get that. You know, and people who are, a lot of people in these factory towns that had their cities denuded of jobs by NAFTA and so on, that appeals to them too. I mean, you know, making rich people pay their fair share. And making sure that people are empowered to form unions and raise their wages and end crazy gap, you know?
And this is why I thought Joe Biden had a really great message. I thought Biden had a good message. In 2022, we did a tour through a number of states through the Midwest. And we went to places that used to have factories that used to create good jobs for the community and used to provide the bedrock of Main Street. And those are gone. Now, a lot of those places, the biggest employers, the drug treatment center or the, you know, the dollar store or something like that, instead of those high wage jobs that created a local economy. I look at Biden's investment in infrastructure and reshoring manufacturing as the great narrative of making those places the places that are going to be. And again, back to the idea of aspirational, the sad reality is I just didn't think he could deliver the punchline. Is this something you think Harris and Walz will pick up on? Because I haven't seen it as much as I would like. I'm curious your thought.
I hope so. I think the, as you say, the people are ready for that. But we can't just talk about what we did. We got to talk about, like you say, what we're going to do, because there's still a lot of people who have a hard time paying for their lives. And I think she's focused on that. Her new kind of framing, a new way forward, helps that. Not only do we have to convince people that the country is on a knife's edge and we could veer toward fascism and authoritarianism, we lose, but if we have a trifecta, if we win the House, the Senate, and the presidency, we could have the most progressive period in modern American history next year, 2025. We could pass all this legislation that affects people's jobs. We could pass, double down on infrastructure. We could pass gun violence legislation that really helps address this horrible gun violence epidemic we have. We could, you know, in raise Social Security and not cut it. We do all those things if we win like that next year.
Well, we can do the things that, you know, as I say, you know, government is to do the things collectively that we can't do individually, like educate a populace, like make sure that people have health security, have some bit of retirement security. Yes. Those are the things that we should be shoring up and allowing people to understand that we're all in this together. What the right has done masterfully, in my view, Bob, over the years, is they've pitched this hyper, hooray for me, the heck with everybody else mentality, this hyper-individualism, which has torn us apart in many ways, but more importantly, torn us apart enough to create the largest billionaire class in the history of civilization and to make us feel that we're hopeless in changing what we see in front of us.
And we have to have, as my colleague Reggie Hubbard says, you got to give them hope if you want them to vote. And that's true. And that's why we got to focus on what we're going to do, not just on the horrors of what they would do if they take back.
No, and there's a lot of horrors. If you just read their book, Project 2025. But while you're reading that, pick up Nuts and Bolts, The Formula for Progressive Electoral Success by Bob Cramer. Wherever you get your favorite books, you will find this. What are you hoping comes out of this, Bob? I mean, this is it's a fascinating book. There's a lot of just packed with information and, you know, on everything political. What are you hoping comes out of this?
Well, I'm hoping that it can be a tool to train organizers who take upon themselves the responsibility of creating the political movement we've got to have to make that modern American, the best, the most progressive period of modern American history happen, both now and as we carry it on, because they ain't going to roll over and play dead if we win this fall. We're going to have to fight for all of these things, but they're very popular. And if we just mobilize people and do that by executing these fundamentals that we talk about in the book, I think we can win.
So what's the gap? What's the gap between, as you said, these ideas are very popular, and I know they are. They're even popular with my red hat friends. I guess the question I keep coming back to is, how did Democrats so badly bungle what are very popular positions and that could make people's lives better? How do we screw this messaging up when we've got the ideas, we've got the policies, you've got all of that stuff, and just not, well, connecting?
Well, part of the problem has been the system of campaign finance reform we have that requires that we depend partially on some of the people we want to make pay their fair share, right? And one of the things we got to do first out next year is to change the system of financing elections, to make it more reliant on ordinary people by amplifying their donations, small donations. And the other thing we got to do is Freedom of Choice Act, the John Lewis Freedom of Choice. I mean, John Lewis.
Freedom to Vote Act. Yeah.
Thank you, sir. Because we got to make sure everybody can vote. I mean, we stop bungling when we understand that our job is to be inclusive and to address this whole question of making people be able to afford their lives and make that the centerpiece of what we're doing, and don't be intimidated by folks who just want to make a whole lot of money and then try and pay off politicians to keep them moderate.
Yeah, because you're right here, because everyone, regardless of political stripes, and I say this all the time, our problems are not right left as much as they are up down. Because on both sides, everyone agrees who the problem is and where the problem lies. And yet we just never seem to come to that action point to where we actually get something done.
Well, we got a lot done the last couple of years, in the first 2 years of the Biden administration, right? I mean, you agree with that totally, I know.
No, I think his administration's been transformational. But again, you know, as somebody who goes, we need more.
Yes.
We got a 1% tax on stock buybacks. I'm like, we should be outlawing those entirely. But I guess 1% is a step to getting where I would like to be.
Well, and as long as we have three families who control as much wealth as the bottom 50% of the population, that's outrageous. And history will look back on our society and say, how is that allowed to be possible? I mean, the same way we look back on medieval societies and how did anybody think the king had a right to govern just because of who his daddy was,
right?
So, I mean, it's an anachronism that we're going to have to face, but if ordinary people agree with that, if we just talk about it. So we have to have that strong populist frame, I think, in order to win.
There you go. Last question I've got for you. How do we take this knowledge, this information, the stuff that comes out of Nuts and Bolts and put this into practice and move this country in the right direction? What's the marching order coming out of this?
The main marching order coming out of it is in this next 2 weeks, 2 months rather, we have to understand that Tim Walz is right. There's lots of time to sleep when we die. We got lots of work to do, and it's up to us. It's not up to to the politicians who are running to just do the right thing. It's all up to us to turn out the vote and to communicate with our neighbors and to build the armies necessary to win in November.
Yeah, it's a whole lot of grassroots organizing. And look, I think back to FDR's. I remember the story. Someone said, hey, I need you to want you to do this. And he said, well, get out in the streets and make me do it. And that, to me, is the message. The book, Nuts and Bolts, The Formula for Progressive Electoral Success. Bob Kramer, the author. We'll get links out on social media. I can take a look at this. Bob, great talking to you.
On Amazon and everything, all the other online.
The dreaded A word.
Well, that is dreaded. You could also get it on Barnes & Noble and the Book Nook and all those.
There you go. Good stuff. Okay. Thanks, Bob. Appreciate it. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back to wrap things up. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. This day in labor history, the year was 1851. That was the day that a Maryland planter named Edward Gorsuch was killed in Christiana, Pennsylvania. Gorsuch had come to Pennsylvania to try and recapture three black men that had escaped from slavery on his farm outside of Baltimore 2 years earlier. A year after the men escaped, Congress passed the Fugitive Slave Act. This penalized helping those who had escaped slavery with a $1,000 fine and up to 6 months in jail. Emboldened by the law, slave catchers chased those who had made the journey to freedom in the North. Gorsuch received news that the men he was looking for were in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. Two of the escaped slaves were at the farm of William Parker, a black man who had also escaped slavery in Maryland. Located just north of the Mason-Dixon line, Lancaster had a well-established Underground Railroad network. An armed black self-defense group had developed to stand against the slave catchers. Gorsuch and his son gathered a group of men and headed north. At the Parker farm, they were confronted by a group of at least 50 black men armed with guns and pitchforks. Gorsuch refused to leave, and a gun battle erupted. Gorsuch was shot and killed in the exchange of fire. Parker, his family, and the three formerly enslaved men fled to Canada. 38 others who were there that day were charged with treason for taking part in the confrontation. This included Castor Hanway, a white man who had tried to defuse the standoff. None of the charged were ever convicted. In the South, slave owners were outraged that no one was punished. Tensions between the North and South sharpened. As a result, the country moved closer to the Civil War, the bloody conflict that finally ended slave labor. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. And look, I think Bob Kramer's spot on. I think one of the biggest mistakes Hillary made, at least in my neighborhood, in 2016, where there were no yard signs anywhere. There were more Hillary for prison signs in my neighborhood than Hillary for president signs. And that was a strategic choice. And I think Bob's right. You know, you got to get out there and do that messaging. The one thing the right has done masterfully, really masterfully, one thing Trump has done masterfully is this idea of merchandising. You know, you've got people literally wearing made up pictures of him like Rambo on their chest. They've got huge flags out in front of their house of him, you know, with basically a Rambo character. Now I see the Marvel, him and Elon Musk are Marvel characters. They have done a masterful job of creating a cult-like, godlike figure out of Trump and then plastering it everywhere for people to see. And the weird thing is now this love affair that he's got with Musk, you know, praising him for firing striking workers, now going to make him the efficiency czar. Understand, Trump will throw him under the bus at some point. But the idea of Musk for efficiency czar is, wow, crazy. The Wall Street Journal a couple weeks ago had a story on Musk's buying Twitter as one of the most historic failures, at least since the collapse. They wrote, the $13 billion that Elon Musk borrowed to buy Twitter has turned into the worst merger finance deal for banks since the 08-09 financial crisis. Evidently, seven banks gave him this money. And what they normally do is they offload it onto someone else and they make their money off the fees, off the transaction fees. Problem is, it's been such a catastrophic failure, so badly managed that they can't offload any of this debt without either incurring massive losses or being stuck with it. And as they point out in the article, the $44 billion acquisition, the loan soured, and they continue to underperform. And that's by design. You're going to destroy it, but you're going to destroy it in a way that only they get their message out. And look, Musk didn't buy Twitter to make it a great company or to make profit. He bought it to destroy what had been something of the left's attempt to reach people. You know, the digital yard sign, if you will. That's why. Because, you know, everyone, even the right was saying, you know, this is where the left gets all their information. We have to destroy that. And they have done it. Congratulations. They completely destroyed it. And look, this is what the right does. They quash what you'll see out of any sanity. And then they do weird things. Understand, they dominate talk radio. They dominate cable news because billionaires have been funding it for years. We find out there's some Russian money, and we've known that for a while, too. And look, we're going to find out a whole lot more as the days, weeks, and months come along on who funds these right-wing message machines. But I find it ironic, and a listener sent me this tweet of this person who was on OAN, and I got to play the video clip because it's this is the most North Korea thing I think that I've ever seen. This is like the most North Korea propaganda news that you're ever going to see. Here is OAN.
He started a movement. Now he has a book to look back on the movement so far. It's called Save America, and it's a beautiful photographic documentary of Trump's presidency and beyond. The striking images show Trump combating the China virus, fighting terrorism, creating jobs, securing the border, unleashing American energy, revitalizing patriotism, and restoring the American spirit. It shows Trump defending our values, our families, our traditions, and our freedom. And it says that, if elected to a second term, the best is yet to come. On the very first page is the 45th president's mugshot. Printed on it in his handwriting, it says, "Never give up, never surrender." This is the main message of these pictures that will assault your eye to ensure that you understand that what he always says is true. In the end, they're not coming after him. They're coming after you. He's just standing in their way.
Wow. I mean, really, wow. I'll even come up with this. Wow. That's news. Evidently, that's news. Assault your eyes. No, what assaults my eyes is the fact that we have media, people posing to be news, hawking books. That's what that was. That was hey, he has this new book. Just like he's got new shoes. Hey, he's got steaks. Hey, he's got, you name the merchandising gimmick. It's really incredible how the entire system is about fleecing the flock for one guy. When did the Republican Party completely become a cult? I'm not sure I was allowed to play that clip or not, but I got to tell you, that's scary stuff. This is the kind of media propaganda that you get in North Korea or Russia. Or China. I mean, this is frightening. That's the punchline. Well, he's always right. You know, they're coming. They're coming for us through him. No. We didn't break any crimes. We didn't break any laws. We didn't do it. He did. I want to hear your thoughts. I mean, seriously, it's really, this is a moment. This is a pivotal moment of the classic, which side are we on? And how do we save this country from the disaster that is, well, that? miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. Freespeech.org, the website to check out the video. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Thanks for tuning in to The Rick Smith Show. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Rick Smith Show. Like us on Facebook.
This is the Buzz of the North.
WBZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.